The Jazz Treasury Podcast is devoted to exhibiting the best of jazz history in the format of an auditory tour of America's richest indigenous music. Bi-weekly, a different aspect of jazz will be presented. It may be a portrait of a musician such as Duke Ellington or John Coltrane. It could be a specific instrument like the bass or trumpet. We may visit a jazz city like Chicago or New Orleans. Other exhibits will focus on genres such as bebop or swing. Your curator and tour guide, Rich Sylvester, has over 40 years of jazz background to share. So, whether you've just begun to explore the art of jazz or consider yourself a connoisseur, tune in to the Jazz Treasury. The Jazz Treasury podcast is always open.
Welcome to the Jazz Treasury. My name is Rich Sylvester. Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode of the Jazz Treasury. In this episode, we look into the jazz piano, and you just heard a classic from the great pianist Scott Joplin. The Entertainer, written by Scott Joplin and recorded in 1903, and we think in New York City, and it's a piano roll. Piano rolls of Joplin's music helped to spread its popularity early in the century. It was only at the end of his life, he died in 1917, that he performed for reproducing rolls. But hand-cut rolls based on the sheet music were widely available and reissued on 78 RPM records in the 1940s and on LPs in the 1970s. The Entertainer illustrates the relative rigidity of ragtime beside the dynamic Harlem stride tradition. The piano is one of the most popular instruments among jazz players and jazz lovers alike. Throughout the music's history, pianists such as Earl Garner have found themselves a niche within the overall range of group styles as soloists or as the leaders of trios. Pianists have also been leaders of significant larger bands, of course. In this episode of the Jazz Treasury, we focus on pianos as featured instruments. Rather like the guitar, the piano has always been part of jazz, and its predecessors, blues and ragtime. Another similarity with the guitar is that performers can be entirely self-sufficient, playing the melody, rhythm, and harmony, and so simulating a whole band. As a result of this, pianists have rather ambivalent relationships to brass and percussion instruments. It is partly a question of volume. While a good piano can be quite powerful, it is not always easy to hear over several jazz horns and an excitable drummer. When public address systems came into more widespread use in the 1920s, pianists sometimes grabbed a microphone and placed it near their instrument. But properly amplified electric pianos were rare before the 1950s and only became common in the 1970s. In earlier days, pianists capitalized on the lack of competition in the studios by playing solo or with just a rhythm section, and managed to create some of the brightest moments in jazz history. This was first noticeable at the turn of the century in the era of ragtime. Rags can be played on an unaccompanied guitar or banjos and were frequently arranged for brass bands or small mixed instrument groups. But the most notable surviving pieces from the ragtime era are those that were composed specifically for the piano by performers such as Scott Joplin. Whether ragtime should be counted as part of jazz history or as the music's immediate precursor, it certainly began the popularization of piano music based on the folk rhythms of Black Americans. As such, it codified a whole style of phrasing. This was also used on wind instruments at the time, but they can only be heard on records from the late 1910s onward. Piano ragtime, on the other hand, was being published 20 years before, at around the same time that mechanical player pianos were being invented. The inclusion of rags on player pianos helped to preserve the sound of ragtime as it was played before the turn of the century. While contemporary legends of jazz, such as cornetist Buddy Bolden, went wholly unrecorded. Time for another track, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to go forward in time a bit to 1921 to listen to James P. Johnson do the Carolina Shout. And this is just James P. Johnson doing solo piano. A little ragtime kind of moving into stride here, recorded in New York City in 1921. Let's listen to James P. Johnson doing Carolina Shout on the Jazz Treasury. Thank you. There he is, James P. Johnson, Carolina Shout. Johnson's 1917 piano roll of this famous piece was the one that Ellington and many others studied at length. The stride action of the left hand is a clear advance over early ragtime when the opening theme is played the second time. The left has its own syncopation. Several of the latter themes in the right hand feature the sound of two adjacent notes played together in order to sound more bluesy. The potential tension between pianists and bands was already in being at this stage. In the sultry climate of New Orleans, bands did much of their playing outdoors, either by the lake, marching through the streets, or riding on floats in processions. It was not easy to take a piano along in any of these situations, and besides, it would have been even less audible in the open air. As a compensation, solo pianists had a virtual monopoly on work in bordello parlors. Only the most upmarket establishments might allow the piano player to hire other musicians from time to time. And keyboard men also tended to have had formal lessons, and they therefore found it easier to move into arranging and composing for other instruments. While most early jazz bands, especially in New Orleans, were led by trumpeters, a large number of later leaders were pianists, including Duke Ellington, Earl Hines, Fletcher Henderson, Louis Russell, Benny Morton, Count Basie, Fats Waller, and the first in a long line, Jelly Roll Morton. And I think it's time to listen to Jelly Roll Morton. Let's listen to a track. This is Jelly Roll Morton doing That's Like It Ought to Be, written by Morton. And this has a trio here with Barney Bigard on clarinet, Jelly Roll Morton on piano, and Zuddy Singleton on drums, recorded in New York City, 1929. Let's listen to Jelly Roll Morton. That's Like It Ought to Be on the Jazz Treasury. Jelly Roll Morton, That's Like It Ought to Be, Morton had his own take on ragtime, like other New Orleanians. That was how he described it, rather than referring it to stride, an East Coast term. As several of his solo performances indicate, he was an excellent pianist, but the fact that he was also an arranger and composer shows to advantage. Jelly Roll Morton's achievements in the 1920s, as a composer and bandleader, sometimes overshadow his ability on the piano, but he was a key figure in the post-ragtime generation. An admirer of ragtime and strongly influenced by it, he helped to shift its rhythmic feel from the original, slightly stilted two in the bar to the typical rolling four that was popular in New Orleans. Ragtime was, of course, popular throughout the USA, and a similar modernizing movement took root in New York and other northern cities. More so than Morton, who was less of a virtuoso than some latter pianists, the East Coast players built up a tradition of showmanship rooted in their brilliant technical abilities. Pianists such as Hubie Blake, James P. Johnson, and Willie the Lion Smith loved to compete with each other and a host of only slightly less excellent players to see who had the most dazzling approach. Their stride piano style, built on the rhythmic chording of the left-hand characteristic of ragtime, flamboyant left-hand leaps and swoops between the bass notes and the middle register chords, became part of the act. Most members of the stride school were gifted composers, but they were also among the first pianists to follow the example of horn players in applying their own style of playing to popular songs of the day. And speaking of Willie the Lion Smith, let's hear one from him. Let's listen to Passionette by Willie the Lion Smith, recorded in New York City, 1938, and two people here, Willie the Lion Smith on piano and O'Neill Spencer on drums. Let's listen to Willie the Lion Smith doing Passionette on the Jazz Treasury.
Listening to the Jazz Treasury Podcast with Rich Sylvester.
Willie the Lion Smith, Passionette, 1938, New York City. As a native New Yorker, Smith didn't buy the theory that jazz originated in New Orleans. He was the acknowledged ringleader of the Harlem Pianists, who ran cutting contests to weed out any up-and-coming competition. Among those who looked up to him was Duke Ellington, who appreciated Smith's light and whimsical approach, heard to advantage in that original composition we just heard, Passionette. Just like the pioneer ragtime pianists, the Harlem Stride pianists were renowned for playing without accompaniment, developing their individual styles at get-togethers in late-night bars or private homes. This was also the form in which newcomers cut their teeth. If they made good, they might be given work at some of the many parlor socials or rent parties where one or at most two piano players would entertain for the entire evening. Another great pianist you might want to listen to is Earl Hines, and there was a whole episode on the Jazz Treasury podcast. Jeez, must have been about 2 years ago. But go back into our library and you can hear a whole episode about Earl Father Hines. Very much worth listening to. He was the next pianist to make a stylistic breakthrough. He worked with a variety of groups in the 1920s, latterly with Louis Armstrong and Jimmy Noon, before receiving an offer, the kind it was best not to refuse, to lead the band at the Al Capone-backed Grand Terrace nightclub. So tune back into Earl Hines or look for him if you can. The other significant keyboard player to appear on the U.S. scene in the 1930s, Art Tatum, must also have been aware of Earl's innovations, although he always cited his preference for the stride work of Fats Waller. Tatum's piano technique was perfect. Jazz musicians everywhere, not just pianists, felt that he bestrode their world like a colossus. Tatum could play in a variety of styles, from Hines's derived right-hand improvisation to a supercharged assault on the stride manner, or a more rhapsodic, sometimes out-of-tempo ballad approach featuring altered harmonies. What he did best was to use all these styles within a single tune, often switching from one to the other every few bars or so. And let's hear that in action. Let's listen to Art Tatum, and let's listen to Art doing I Would Do Anything for You. And this is a trio again, Art Tatum on piano, Tiny Grimes on guitar. That's someone to look for. I heard him first in a group called The Cat's Fiddle, I believe, from 1930s. If you can find anything by The Cat's Fiddle, you'll be amazed at their harmonies and their instrumentation is fantastic. Anyway, this track we'll be listening to, Art Tatum, I Would Do Anything for You, Art Tatum on piano, Tiny Grimes on guitar, and Slam Stewart on bass, New York City, 1944. Thank you. That was Art Tatum. I would do anything for you. Rather than choose a track where Tatum's technique dazzles the listener, it's good to focus on his sheer musicality. This lesser-known recording of a song associated with one of the many pianist bandleaders of the era, Claude Hopkins, underlines Tatum's harmonic sense and the rhythmic solidity of his blend with the trio. That was Art Tatum. Look for anything by him, and you'll be doing just fine. Another great pianist, on which we had a whole episode, Thelonious Monk, was associated with the early bebop years, also had a presence in the clubs of Harlem, especially at the famous Mentons. But, like Tatum, whom he also admired, he was too much of an individual to be at home in a group situation. The same can be said of famous contemporary of Monk and Powell, who went out to forge a strong solo career. When Tatum died in 1956, Earl Garner was just beginning to capitalize on his joyously swinging and notably individual approach to jazz piano, and he was able to leave behind the nightclub and perform in concert halls all over the world. We're going to listen to a little Monk here. I have a track by Thelonious Monk, early Monk, and it's called Off Minor, written by Thelonious Monk. Again, a trio with Thelonious Monk on piano, Gene Rainey on bass, Art Blakey on drums, New York City, 1947. Let's listen to Thelonious Monk, Off Minor, on the Jazz Treasury. That was Monk, Off Minor. The enigmatic Monk has been just as much of a hero as Oscar Peterson in the last half century, not so much to the general public, but mainly to fellow musicians, and not just pianists. His quirky approach to the keyboard is comparable to his unusual but logical compositions. This piece that we heard, Off Minor, was recorded in a more conventional version by Bud Powell. The way that Monk develops his improvisation is fascinatingly different. And yes, we did an episode on Bud Powell as well. So go back into our Jazz Treasury Library and check it out. And then, of course, we have Oscar Peterson, the Canadian-born Oscar Peterson, an admirer and friend of both Tatum and Nat King Cole, seemed at first destined to crush horn players in his fists. Interestingly, he has a more subtle side that makes him an excellent accompanist for certain players, although he clearly prefers to have the limelight to himself. Let's listen to a little Oscar Peterson, and this is a track called Runnin' Wild. And it is another trio, Oscar Peterson on piano, Burt Brown on bass, and Russ Dufort on drums, recorded in New York City, actually recorded in Montreal in 1946. Anyway, let's listen to Oscar Peterson doing Runnin' Wild on the Jazz Treasury. Okay, that was Oscar Peterson, at the age of 20. Oscar Peterson was still sorting through a mass of influences, including that of Art Tatum, whom he got to know before the latter's death in 1956. His right-hand lines sound a lot like Nat King Cole, and the energy and expertise that have been bywords in his performance for nearly 50 years are already clearly discernible. And that was in 1946, Oscar Peterson. And you should know, there weren't just black pianists that were notable. There were white stylists as well. Two other important stylists of this period were the extremely popular British-born player George Shearing and the minority taste theoretician Lenny Tristano. Both of them were blind and were among the first white pianists with markedly individual styles. The last point could also be made about Dave Brubeck. And, with much more justification, Bill Evans. The impact of Evans has been felt from the 1960s onward. If any pianist has been as widely influential as Hines and Powell down the decades, it has to be Bill Evans, whose approach echoes through the work of Herbie Hancock, Chick Corea, Keith Jarrett, and many others. All right, time to finish up here. We have one more track to listen to from the royalty of jazz, Duke Ellington, Dancers in Love. And this is recorded in 1945. Just two people here, Duke Ellington on piano and Junior Raglan on bass. Let's listen to Duke Ellington, Dancers in Love, recorded in New York City, 1945, on the Jazz Treasury. That's Duke Ellington, Dancers in Love. Despite Duke's modesty about his piano playing and the infrequent feature spots he gave it, he was as astute at the keyboard as in front of the band. This piece, which was originally part of his Perfume Suite, compares well with Pitter Panther Patter as a striking demonstration of his ability and of his fondness for the stride players, especially in the middle section. The opening theme is a sort of avant-garde ragtime. All right, before we sign off here, I'd like to tell you a little bit about some recommended listening. Several great new piano stylists emerged in the 1950s, sometimes redefining what was considered jazz. These albums that I'll mention contain the best work of four of them. George Shearing, Jazz Masters, 1957. Bill Evans, Everybody Digs Bill Evans, 1958. Horace Silver, Horace Silver Trio, 1952-53. And Dave Brubeck, Brubeck Plays Brubeck, 1956. And for a slightly more modern approach to jazz, listen to Dave Brubeck's Time Out. All right, that's all for this episode of the Jazz Treasury. My name is Rich Sylvester. Thank you so much for tuning in. And please share. Share with your family. Share with your friends. Help keep the flame of jazz alive. Go to our Facebook page, the Jazz Treasury Podcast. Give us a like. Give us a share. Leave some comments. Make some recommendations. Please, and just to let you know, the information we get for this most of this podcast is from the Jazz Greats magazine, put out by the Marshall Cavendish Collection or Foundation back in the 1990s. And thank you so much for their information and their music. Thank you so much for listening. The background music you hear is by a great pianist named Benny Green. Next time on the Jazz Treasury, we'll be looking at the jazz clarinet, another focus on an instrument. The clarinet runs like a bright thread through the pattern of jazz, winding its way into the fabric from New Orleans in 1930 Chicago to the international present. Clarinetists such as Johnny Dodds and Benny Goodman are numbered among the greatest of jazz musicians. Featured in this next episode, and varied collection are such individualists as Jimmy Noon, Pee Wee Russell, Albert Nichols, among many classic clarinet tracks are Johnny Dodd's Piggly Wiggly, Alfonso Picot's High Society, and Barney Bagard's Clarinet Lament. Stay tuned. Next time on the Jazz Treasury, we visit the jazz clarinet. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time, enjoy the jazz.